Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Following a list of speakers and coming in at the end, a list of speakers like Arnold de Borgraf and Norman Podhoretz and Frank Shakespeare and Anthony Harrigan and Richard Pipes and Pete Utley, and coming in at the end, reminds me very much of Zsa Gabor's eighth husband, who was heard to say on his wedding night, "I know what's expected of me, but can I make it interesting?" I'm going to try to do that by opening my discussion about a movie that I saw recently, a movie which is called, some of you may have seen it as well, it's playing right down the block here at 59th and 5th Avenue. The movie is called Hopscotch. It's with Walter Matthau and Glenda Jackson, hero and heroine respectively. The villain of the film is an overweight buffoon with a fat, pudgy face, a fool, an idiot, a conceited pig, a blunderer, a man without taste, malicious, stupid, homicidal, vengeful, cruel, irritating, disgusting, foul-mouthed, a victim of maniacal temper tantrums. He hasn't a single redeeming virtue. And who is this horror? A bomb-throwing terrorist? A knife-wielding slasher? A drug-crazed hippie? A child molester? A stick-up artist? An arsonist? An escaped convict with four hostages? None of the above. The villain in Hopscotch is an executive of the Central Intelligence Agency, a chap named Meyerson. Now, you might say that in casting the CIO executive in charge of dirty tricks as the villain, the film producers were merely demonstrating their contempt for all intelligence officers, but not so. The KGB executive, named Yazov, is an excellent, decent sort of chap. His accented English is charming, something like Charles Boyer's. He dresses with good taste, wears a beautifully groomed mustache. His manners are impeccable. He is kindly, fair-minded, unflappable. He never loses his temper. He has a luminous smile and a drawing room manner. Now, the plot concerns the mistreatment of Walter Matthau, longtime CIO station chief in Austria with a fine record of spy catching. His boss, Meyerson, however, recalls him to Washington for some irrational reason and demotes him despite years of loyal service to the CIA. Matthau decides on revenge. Single-handedly, he will make a fool of the CIA. To help him, he enlists Glenda Jackson, his one-time secretary, recently widowed and wealthy, and of course delighted to become his mistress once more. With one exception, all of the CIA officers are stupid beyond redemption, ready to follow their chief Meyerson's orders as if he were the camp commandant at Auschwitz. The exception is a young man who worked for and still admires Matthau, but even he might be prepared to kill his former boss if necessary for the good of the CIA. It turns out that the KGB would also like to be rid of Matthau, this maverick ex-CIA officer, and so the CIA and KGB work together, informally, of course, to track down Matthau and to dispose of him. The KGB, not seeking to trespass on its rival's jurisdiction, leaves it to the CIA to try to kill its erstwhile employee. But nobody can catch this elusive Scarlet Pimpernel who turns up here, there, and everywhere without disguise, outwitting the CIA he has deserted at every turn. In fact, were it not for the KGB, the bumbling CIA would never have found Matthau's trail. Both sides want to be rid of Matthau because he's writing a book about the inside of the CIA and their dirty tricks. And incidentally, he mentions the KGB. And Matthau delights in mailing both the CIA and the KGB each chapter as it is finished. There is a scene where the CIA's Meyerson unsuccessfully tries to intimidate the British publisher into suppressing the book, but it is published posthumously. In actual fact, Matthau tricks both CIA and KGB into believing that he has been killed right before their very eyes in an explosion over the English Channel of an airplane which he is supposedly flying in a getaway attempt from the CIA. But Matthau is on the ground, hidden in the shack, manipulating some radio electronic control over the plane, which he explodes at the right time, making it appear that Meyerson, the CIA blunderer, firing from a chase helicopter, has shot down this traitor. The last scene shows Matthau crudely disguised as a brown-faced, turbaned Asian and accompanied by Glenda Jackson, living a happy fantasy life on her wealth and his royalties, because Matthau's book has, of course, become a bestseller. When the film ends and the endless screen credits begin to unroll, a marvelous sentence appears. I've never seen it before for any other movie. I quote it. This film was made in accordance with the laws of the United States of America, period, unquote. How virtuous and how respectful, how law-abiding and how disgusting and how sanctimonious. For there is a political message in Hopscotch, a frightening message indeed. First, there is no enemy called the USSR served by the KGB. The enemy is the CIA. Broadly speaking, U.S. intelligence. The enemy is the bumbling, lawless CIO executive, a sort of Dr. Strangelove of intelligence, aided and abetted by his weak-chinned, Fu Manchu mustached CIA yes-trigger men who Matthau gulls all to the audience's delight. Second, the movie reflects the adversary political culture of our time. This is the CIA, a monstrosity, a rogue elephant, a dinosaur with guns. What intelligent, decent person would ever want to work for this agency when it consists of murderous morons like Meyerson? Even the KGB chaps like Yazov are nicer gentlemen. Unlike the boors at the CIA who Matthau outwits so easily. Indeed, if one had a choice of working for Yazov or Meyerson, is there any question which an intelligent, decent person would choose? Third, if the enemy is the CIA, then obviously its sponsor, the government of the United States, is the super enemy, since it has given birth to this monster. Which, of course, is wonderfully paradoxical. The same superenemy, the U.S. government, which created the CIA, also created the laws under whose aegis Hopscotch boasts that they produced this film, in case you want to get mad at them. It's as if the government were the film's co-producer. When U.S. intelligence becomes the butt of savage ridicule, I am impelled to ask, why don't Hollywood and the TV networks, including the PBS network, make films which, with the same imagination, indignation, and sense of the ridiculous, would show what's going on in Eastern Europe or the Soviet Union? Are intelligence agencies all bad and immoral, or only the CIA? Or why is the Soviet military presence at the Khyber Pass and the Afghan resistance not an epic movie? After all, the Khyber Pass was always a magnificent backdrop for the imperialist shenanigans of the British with Ronald Coleman or Gary Cooper or Michael Caine walloping the Wogs. Where, oh, where is Francis Fitzgerald or David Halberstam to write movie scripts on the horrors of Afghanistan, the Soviet napalming of little Afghan children as they flee along the mountain roads? Couldn't Hollywood make a great drama of the life and death of Joseph Stalin and his own daughter's repudiation of a father? Why is the Soviet dissident movement immune from Hollywood's ministrations? The Battle of Hungary is now a quarter century old, and the second occupation of Czechoslovakia 12 years old, and still no Hollywood films. The East German uprising is 27 years old, but since it was against the Soviet Union, there is no movie. TV is still fascinated with Hitler, the Nazis, and the Holocaust, but Stalin, the Bolsheviks, and the Soviet Holocaust does not fascinate TV. By all means, let's see The Diary of Anne Frank on TV, but is there no TV film in The Diary of Alexander Solzhenitsyn or The Diary of Vladimir Bukovsky? In a society and culture whose media powers and controllers see the United States as the enemy, while thousands, hundreds of thousands, flee Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, Cuba, East Germany, the USSR, or in a society and culture whose media powers see the CIA as the enemy, the question must be raised, qui potest? Who profits? If intelligence agencies are bad, wicked, and immoral, then they are all bad, not just one. That isn't the case with Hollywood, and in particular with such a movie as Hopscotch, which reflects the dominant adversary culture of the 1970s. I take the Hopscotch movie seriously because it is a measure of how far America's sense of the world crisis has declined. A recent report on American readiness disclosed that only one of the U.S. Army's 10 divisions are combat ready. 60% of the Air Force's tactical fighters cannot be used immediately. More than half of the Navy's fleet has serious readiness deficiencies. A recent report in the London Economist estimated that military spending is now taking somewhere between 11% and 18% of Soviet GNP, compared with 5.2% for the United States. According to Aviation Week just a few weeks ago, Soviet defense spending has grown 4 to 5% in real terms since 1965 and will continue to increase through 1985. And still, the CIA is the enemy. If there were a feeling of urgency about Soviet arms superiority and Soviet expansionism, is it conceivable that a senator could say, and I quote, "What is the threat from the Soviet Union?" asked the senator. "We do not know for sure." I remember when we had a conversation with Mr. Kosygin in the Soviet Union, he was very concerned as he talked about the need for roads, automobiles, and consumer goods. He was very much concerned about the influence of his generals and his admirals on the course of policy in his country. "It occurred to me," said the senator, "that hawks and doves are not confined to the United States alone." The United States Senate who uttered that piece of wisdom was Claiborne Pell, and I wonder whether the Rhode Island Democrat would still believe such palpable disinformation. I credit this quotation to a superb article which I recommend you read in the current commentary for November by Joshua Morovchik called Turnabout in the Senate. If there were a sense of alarm about the world crisis in the U.S. media, would such a publication as Counterspy, I don't know if you've seen this magazine, but you can pick it up at your neighborhood grocer, I'm sure, as Counterspy be circulating in this country, easily obtainable at newsstands, college bookstores, and other outlets, in the name of freedom of the press, circulating, if you please, under the protection of the laws of the United States, so that it has a post office box at the Ben Franklin Station in Washington, D.C., where by the same laws of the United States, the counterintelligence agencies are today forbidden to conduct a mail cover on Counterspy. A magazine, which I'm referring to the summer 1980 issue, publishes the names of South Koreans who have had U.S. police training and the names of addresses of alleged CIA officers in the U.S. Embassy in Seoul and names and addresses of alleged CIA officers in the U.S. Embassy in Sweden. If there were a sense of realistic concern about the world crisis in the U.S. print and electronic media, and even perhaps in Congress, would such a TV film as On Company Business have been produced and shown by PBS? This three-part expose of the CIA was financed by the U.S. taxpayer, who puts up the money for PBS via the National Endowment for the Arts, and also by grants from the Ford Foundation and the Independence Documentary Fund. The special consultant was Philip Agee, a KGB plant in the CIA, and his name was listed in the credits for the film, but there was no mention, no expose of AG, no background on him. When films like Hopscotch and On Company Business, what these films demonstrate is what too few Americans realize, that American intelligence, and particularly counterintelligence, has been and is in a dangerous condition indeed. Worst of all is that the pillar on which all intelligence depends, counterintelligence, has crumbled to such a degree that there are informed persons who believe that to try to help the CIA on the road to recovery after 5 years of hamstringing presidential executive orders, attorney general guidelines, congressional investigations, internal shakeups and purges would be a mistake. Why? Because in those trying years during which the CIA became a football for men like Senator Church, and let us not overlook the fact that some of the CIA's wounds were self-inflicted, the CIA may have been turned around. In intelligence jargon, that means that instead of serving the national interest, it may now be serving the enemy KGB interest. And let me refer you to the highly successful penetration for the KGB by David H. Barnett, an important CIO officer. And as you heard the other night from Arno de Borgrav, this may well be the tip of the iceberg. Last September 28th, Edward J. Epstein wrote in the New York Times Magazine that the CIA, he quote him, must eventually come to terms with the possibility that there is a mole problem. And the CIA must come to terms with that if it is to retain confidence in its effectiveness as a clandestine intelligence service. Even worse is the widespread agreement among knowledgeable persons that the CIA has been unable to penetrate the Soviet system with dependable sources of its own. Dependable, that is, to the extent that CIA counterintelligence would accept the unimpeachability of these sources. Consider, for example, the ease of travel, on the other hand, for Soviet and Soviet bloc citizens into and around the United States, and the impossibility of similar travel by foreigners in the USSR. It is now fairly simple to assign, literally by the shipload, Soviet agents to operate in this country. In 1978, there were 1,300 Soviet and 700 Soviet bloc officials permanently assigned to this country as diplomats, media and trade representatives, and to staffs of international organizations located in New York or Washington. According to Edward J. O'Malley, assistant director of the FBI Intelligence Division, in an article in Washington Weekly, the number of such Soviet and Soviet bloc officials in the U.S. is now up to 2,600 from 2000 to 1978. According to O'Malley, about 30% are known or suspected intelligence officers. Far more significant are the Soviet bloc visitors, not officials, to the U.S. In 1977, there were 60,000 such visitors. Of these 60,000, 14,000 were members of commercial, scientific, and cultural delegations. The remaining 46,000 were crewmen who enjoyed complete liberty while the Soviet bloc ships docked in any of our 40 U.S. deep water ports. Today, according to the FBI's O'Malley, some 35,000 such crewmen enter our ports each year. The FBI used to, before the congressional furor, the FBI routinely used to cover KGB suspect agents on a one-to-one basis. That is, one FBI surveillance operative to one KGB suspect. Today, the ratio is 1-4, one FBI to four suspects. There are simply too many KGB targets floating about the U.S. today, while some 300 Justice Department employees are busy checking applications from all kinds of dubious sources under the Freedom of Information Act. Let me quote former Assistant Attorney General Antonin Scalia, now a professor at the University of Chicago Law School, and he says, "A story I often tell is that when I was in the Justice Department, concern was expressed by the National Aeronautics and Space Agency, NASA, that it was receiving a regular series of requests from AMTORG, the Soviet trading company in this country. And they asked the Justice Department, was there anything they could do about it under the Freedom of Information Act? And of course, the answer was no. The Act doesn't make any distinction with respect to citizens or aliens or foreign companies, so it's not an unreal problem. But the Act was quite clearly drawn that way, and intentionally so. I don't think," said Professor Scalia, "it was an oversight. AMTORG can get information under the Freedom of Information Act." Incredible. Thus, foreigners and foreign governments, regardless of whether friend or foe, have the right under American law, those laws of the United States, to information from all agencies of the American government. Now, with this state of affairs limited to a few government agencies, the damage might be controllable, but the damage extends far beyond that. It threatens the very existence of counterintelligence, without which there can be no operative intelligence system. To put it simply, the crisis of U.S. intelligence is a crisis of counterintelligence. Newton S. Myler, the former chief of operations in the CI, counterintelligence staff, of the CIA under James Angleton, recently told a meeting of the Consortium on the Study of Intelligence that the United States does not today have an effective counterintelligence capability. He told us that neither the CIA nor the FBI is today able to detect or neutralize Soviet and Soviet bloc intelligence activity in the U.S. Richard Helms, former CIA director, has told us that, and I quote him, without an effective counterintelligence program, both in the CIA, which means overseas, and the FBI domestic, the problem of double agents and infiltrators are insurmountable. Myler, whom I quoted earlier, says we haven't any CI capacity today. Does that account for the David Barnett penetration? Are there any other Barnetts still uncovered within the CIA? Throughout the 5 years that eight powerful congressional committees have exercised their oversight privilege on the CIA, little attention has been paid to the presence of the KGB in the United States. It should be regarded as a matter of the highest importance that the Senate Judiciary Committee, which fortunately will be under new management in January 1981, immediately undertake an investigation of KGB activities in the U.S., and in North America, if possible. This investigation should, of course, also include examination of activities of the secret services of the East European bloc countries as well. Look at this simply, at the problem of counterintelligence. Had there been a successful British counterintelligence, could the Philbys, the Blunts, the McLeans have flourished for so long? The new Reagan administration is now engaged in planning a transition to what I hope will be a new approach to the problem of U.S. intelligence for the 1980s. And here I want to congratulate the Heritage Foundation's excellent study, which has been presented to the transition team. One of the authors of that report, I believe, is in the room, Angela Codavilla. And I hope that they will pay attention to it in the transition team to this excellent job. But particular attention must be paid to the weakest link in the intelligence chain, counterintelligence, whose job is fourfold. First, to protect our own intelligence operations. Two, to discover deception and disinformation. Three, to uncover secret political operations directed against this country. And four, to keep spies and terrorists from being successful. The CI assignment raises ethical problems which cannot be dealt with successfully unless we understand the meaning of Soviet totalitarianism. And unless we realize, in the words of Professor M.R.D. Foote, that, and I quote, the best hope that the free world will remain free lies in an efficient, constitutional, freedom-loving, but adequately secret CIA and FBI. We should also recall the words of Dag Hammarskjöld, who once wrote, the road to holiness necessarily passes through the world of action. I agree that there have been abuses by the FBI and the CIA, and as I said earlier, some of the problems of U.S. intelligence agencies have been the result of self-inflicted wounds. But as Mark Twain once said, we should be careful to get out of any experience only the wisdom that is in it and stop there, lest we be like the cat that sits down on the hot stove lid. She will never sit down on a hot stove lid again, and that is well. But also, she will never sit down on a cold one anymore. The Republican National Platform on Intelligence, which we must assume contains the guiding principles for the Reagan administration, declared the U.S. intelligence community had lost much of its ability to supply the president with adequate information. The second point it made is that the foreign intelligence services in democratic countries have become increasingly reluctant to cooperate with U.S. agencies. Third, the U.S. intelligence community had incorrectly assessed critical foreign developments, notably in Iran, and notably about the Soviet Union's military efforts. Four, the U.S. had required a realistic assessment of the threat it faces, and it pledged to improve it. Now, the platform calls for a reestablishment of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, abolished by the Carter administration. It pledges to enable intelligence officers and their agents to operate safely and efficiently abroad. This will be a legislation will probably pass to do something about protecting the identities of CIA agents and to prevent unauthorized disclosures of U.S. intelligence sources and methods. And third, it pledges to amend the Freedom of Information Act and the Privacy Act to permit meaningful background checks on individuals being considered for sensitive positions and to reduce costly and capricious requests to the intelligence agencies. And I dare say, had there been a meaningful background checks on individuals who entered the Carter administration, a good many of them would not have been able to have been employed there for the last 4 years. The fourth pledge demands that the government will provide the capability to try to attempt to influence international events which are vital to our national security interests, a capability which only the United States among the major powers has denied itself. This is a euphemism for a pledge to restore covert action under intelligence agencies. And last, to seek adequate safeguards to ensure that past abuses will not recur, but we will seek the repeal of ill-considered restrictions which have debilitated U.S. intelligence while easing the intelligence collection and subversion efforts of our adversaries. And there you have it, the intention of President-elect Reagan to restore our intelligence agencies to a level of strength which will make it possible to compete with what has been unchecked KGB power throughout the non-communist world. We must be prepared for opposition to what will be the Reagan Intelligence Charter, opposition based on constitutional claims such as freedom of the press and the right that some of the media will claim to publish and to broadcast what they wish about intelligence operations and intelligence officers. There will be serious moral questions raised against the restoration of the intelligence agencies to peak efficiency, and the debate will be long and hard. It may be a meaningful contribution to that upcoming debate to recall something the distinguished philosopher Emil Falkenhayn wrote in 1948 in the pages of Commentary. And he said, "In the 20th century, men, all of us, find themselves compelled to commit or condone evil for the sake of preventing an evil believed to be greater. And the tragedy is that we do not know whether the evil we condone will not in the end be greater than the evil we seek to avert or even be identified with it." I often remember a line I once came across in Aristotle, in which he said that the essence of political tragedy is to make the perfect the enemy of the good. In the 1980s, we shall be dealing with an enemy who disdains to conceal his aims. It is an enemy who openly recruits proxy armies, as in Angola, engages in direct aggression, as in Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Afghanistan, and tomorrow perhaps in Poland, who has developed the will and capacity for massive covert interventions anywhere in the world, and who has self-legitimated these actions by the Brezhnev Doctrine. January 20th, 1981, may well be the most fateful date in world history. Stay tuned. Thank you.